As the poison passed through his lips and over his tongue, I can't help but imagine that there were two questions running through the mind of perhaps the greatest questionnaire in all of history. Number one, how long will it take for the hemlock poison to kill me? And number two, who is the one true God? It would be just a matter of time before Socrates, one of the greatest intellectuals in all of humanity, would be lying dead. He was executed, ironically, for atheism. That is, he had come to the conclusion and rejected the gods of the day. In his mind, through questioning and reason, he was convinced that there was only one true God. Now, he would readily admit that he did not know who this one true God was, but he was firmly convinced within his mind the idols and false gods of the day that plagued Greek society was not him. Socrates, who lived four centuries before Christ, was a stonecutter by trade. Thus, the possibility exists that he could have been the very one to carve the inscription on that altar in the midst of Mars Hill to the unknown God. Had he not, a very real possibility exists that someone whom he had influenced in some shape, form, or fashion had done so. It was at Mars Hill, or the Areopagus, the very place that Socrates stood trial for his life for rejecting the gods of the day, convinced there was only one true God, that 500 years later, the Apostle Paul would stand in the midst of the Athenian intellectuals and he would declare unto them the nature of the unknown God. If you have your Bible at hand, I'm going to ask you to open to the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. And I want to analyze this sermon in our brief moment that we have here and point out some things. There are many lessons that we can learn and time will not allow us to cover them all, but I want to point a few things out from this sermon. Number one, I want to point out that the Apostle Paul upheld the truth. In the 18th verse, we read, "Then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, 'What does this babbler want to say?' Others said, 'He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection.'" Now we have two philosophical groups here, the Epicureans and the Stoics, and they're the main driving force of the, quote, knowledge and learning and education that's going on in the city of Athens at this time. And so they hear the Apostle Paul, they understand he's teaching something different, and they propose the question, what does this babbler want to say? Now that word babbler literally means picking up seeds. And originally, the word meant a bird picking a seed up out of the field. As time would go on, it kind of expanded its meaning. And so it would come to note those who would follow merchants around, and when something would fall off their cart or fall off their table, they would run over and they would scoop it up or they would pick it up. By the time we get to Mars Hill, the 17th chapter of the book of Acts, it took on a new meaning. You see, they were wanting to learn anything that they could that was new. And so someone might pick up a few thoughts here and a few thoughts there, and then they might try to present them as their own and try to teach some new thing to captivate the attention of the intellectuals and perhaps build their case for who they were. They wanted to know, what's this babbler saying? What kind of information did he pick up? Is he going to share with us? Probably not lending very much credibility to him. They thought, well, maybe he's a proclaimer of foreign gods. And they used the phrase gods, plural, because when he talked about Jesus and the resurrection, they were under the impression that they were two different gods. And the word strange does not mean odd, but just foreign, something new to them that they didn't know. And so what does Paul do? He preaches unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Notice the importance of preaching Jesus. Here is Paul in the midst of Mars Hill. Everywhere he looks, there's altars, there's idols, there's idolatry, there's false gods. And I can't help but think the statement made by Jesus is going through his hand when Jesus said in John chapter 14 and verse 6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." You know, it's easy to talk about Christianity amongst friends. It's easy in a Christian nation or the Bible Belt, so to speak, to talk about God and the gospel. But it becomes difficult when you're in a foreign place and there's other world religions there. And here's Paul in the midst of all of it, and he's proclaiming Jesus. He's also teaching about the resurrection. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 to verse 14, the Apostle Paul makes an argument for a bodily resurrection based upon the fundamental fact that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And in verse 14 he says, "And if Christ is not risen, then our preaching is empty and your faith is opto empty." If Jesus is not resurrected from the grave, there would be no such thing as a 4th of July meeting. We would not be gathered here together, and many of us that we know would never have met. But we love one another. We care for one another. We long to see each other and pray for one another because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That was the focal point of the preaching. Go back to the early chapters of the book of Acts. What did Peter preach on the day of Pentecost? The resurrected Christ. What did they preach in chapter 3? The resurrected Christ. What did they preach in chapter 4? The resurrected Christ. Why were they thrown in prison? Why were the Sadducees so upset at them? Because they didn't believe in a resurrection. And that's why they were fighting them tooth and nail in the early chapters of the book of Acts. Number 2, I want to notice with you that people are willing to consider the truth. Go to verse 19 through 21. "And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, 'May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean.' For all the Athenians and foreigners who spent their time there and nothing else but whether to tell or hear something new." They wanted to consider the truth. Now, how sincere were they? I don't know. I wasn't there. But I do know they were willing to consider it. And I do know this, that people today are willing to consider the truth. How sincere are they about obeying it? How much are they willing to commit their life to it? I can't answer that question. Every heart and every mind is different. But I do know that people are willing to consider it, and it's our responsibility to share it with them. I wonder, when was the last time you invited someone to church? Have you ever invited someone to church? When was the last time that you asked someone to study the Bible with you? Have you ever studied the Bible with someone? Number 3, most people are inherently religious. Notice verse 22. "Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious.'" Now the King James Version uses the old word superstitious, and the New King James uses the word religious. Superstitious is probably too strong of a word, almost as if it's a slap in the face. Religious is probably giving them a little too much credit. It's difficult to ascertain the exact meaning of that Greek word. It probably falls somewhere in between the two. But this I know, people generally speaking are religiously minded. Now the religion might not be what we think of when it comes to religion, but all of us at some point in our life, when we reach an accountable age or an age of maturity, ask this simple question: why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? Even the atheist is religious. They practice a different form of religion than you and I, but they are. You see, most people tend to be religious. Now let's move very quickly into the heart of the sermon. Because the Apostle Paul notices them, he says, "I perceive that you're religious, and I noticed as I was walking around that you have an altar with this inscription on it, 'To the unknown God.'" Verse 23. They had a desire to know everything. They wanted to be the most intellectual people on the face of the earth. And here Paul is standing in the modern day courtyard of Cambridge or Oxford or somewhere like that. And he's proclaiming unto them the truth. And he says, I want to tell you something about the unknown God. And this is the fascinating part of Paul's sermon. Because as Paul describes unto them the very nature of the true and living God that we serve, he's contrasting him with the false gods and the idols of the day. Now, we don't have time to go into all this, so I'm going to rattle off very quickly some things for you to consider. Verses 24 through 29 is the heart of the sermon. And notice with me, number one, according to verse 24, he teaches God is in control. That's in direct opposition to what the Stoics believed. They didn't think God was in control. Number two, he taught in verse 25 that God is the sustainer. You see, the Greeks of that time believed that they had to sustain the gods. And so they would cook a meal and take it down and place it upon the altar and leave it there for them. God doesn't need us to sustain him. He is the sustainer. Number three, according to verse 25 in the last phrase, God is the creator. They didn't believe that. I'm going to tell you that they believed in a form of evolution, not in the evolution that's being taught today, but they had their own theories about the origins of life. And Paul wanted to explain unto them that God is the creator. Number four, he taught there is but one blood, no racism. Verse 26. I've never seen anything like it in the last 10 or 12 years. Everyone is a racist. If you don't believe me, turn on the news. Doesn't matter what channel, just turn on the news. Everyone is a racist. There is no call for racism whatsoever. We were all, regardless of the color of our skin, where we live on the globe, or what language we speak, of one blood. We all were created by God, and we have a soul. And everyone, regardless who they are or where they are, deserves the opportunity to have the gospel preached to them. And it's our responsibility to do that. Amen. Number five, he reveals the true nature of God in verses 28 and 29. He appeals to them for why they are wrong in practicing their idolatry and their paganism. I want to share with you one final point in our remaining time, and that's this. Unfortunately, we cannot control the response of people to the gospel. As much as I would like to force someone to study the Bible, as much as I would like to force someone to obey the gospel in the form of baptism, I wouldn't do any good anyway. I can't do that. Ultimately, they have to make the decision. Verses 32 through 34 reads, and when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, while others said, we will hear you again on this matter. So Paul departed from among them. However, some men joined him and believed. There was a mixed bag of results. He was talking about Jesus and the resurrection. He's talking about life eternal. And some of them made fun of him. Some of them said, well, maybe we ought to think about this a little bit more. And some of them believed. You know, when you preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, you're going to have a mixed bag of results. In the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, we read of the parable of the sower. And there are four types of soils, or you might say there are four conditions of the heart. There's the wayside soil, where the seed is scattered and immediately the birds come and steal it away. Then there's the stony ground, where the seed emerges, but very quickly it fades as soon as the trials start. Then there's the thorny ground, which it comes up and things are looking really good for a while until the weeds come around and just completely choke it out. Then there's the good ground, the good heart that's fruitful and does exceptionally well. You see, if you preach the gospel very long, you've come to the conclusion that these four conditions of the heart are a reality. Every preacher here has experienced that. And probably every one of you in your home congregation have experienced these four things. You share the gospel with someone, and it's like it just bounces off of their heart immediately, and they don't want anything to do with it. Sometimes you share the gospel with them and they obey the gospel like that, and you're thrilled and you're excited, and it's just a matter of weeks and they're gone. They can't handle it. Other times you begin preaching the gospel and they obey the gospel and things look good. They come to church for a year and a half, and all of a sudden life chokes them out. But every once in a while you find that good heart. And that seed is planted, and it germinates, and it grows, and it produces. This is all I really know about it. You won't find the good heart if you're not spreading the seed. That's our responsibility. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature.